Hey everyone, welcome back to Talking Success. We're staying away from Africa, actually, for the second time in 2 weeks. And we're going over to Europe today. And whilst I've kind of mastered pronouncing very African names, my Greek isn't too great, but I'm going to give this a go anyway. So, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone else that's tuning in, please welcome Panayiotis Kriaris. I think I've got that right. All the way over from Europe. I did sort of preempt this before we jumped on the recording to say, listen, the least I can do is get your name right. You're a guest on our show, and I hope I did your name justice. If I didn't, my humble apologies. But listen, thanks so much for joining us on the show today. I think what we'd like to talk about is, so last week we had Ron Shevlin on from the States, and he gave us a really good overview about some of the dynamics, some of the trends, some of the things he's seeing working and maybe not so much working in the USA and North America. I'd love to sort of give our audience a bit of an overview in terms of what's happening, what are the trends, what are the market conditions in Europe, because obviously that's a continent you know very, very well and have done for many, many years. But before we get into the good stuff, if you can give our audience a bit of an intro, if they've not probably not seen your face or may have seen your face but probably not heard you, I would probably guess they would know your name because our audience are all kind of fintech enthusiasts. But if you can give a bit of an overview, Panayiotis, that would be amazing.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you for the invitation. Well done pronouncing my difficult name. I know it's always a problem for at least some people. Great to be on the show and great to be able to discuss a bit about fintech, about Europe. I mean, Ron is a very good one. He knows very well the market in the US, so I'll do my best to at least match what his performance last week.
Wonderful. And in terms of your job, just to give some context, and I know you've been in the world of banking and remittance, yeah, and Worldpay, and what are you doing now, and sort of where did your interest in the world of fintech come from?
That's a great question, actually. So as you rightly said, I have a background in payments, in fintech over the past many years. And I've always been on the business side. I would say I was progressively moving within the space. So I was lucky enough to be doing many things both on the retail side and on the corporate side, on the SME side. So I understand both well. As I said, I've always been on the business side. I mean, payments is actually, I mean, it didn't used to be perceived as such, but I think payments has always been a core of what financial services are. The only thing is that lately, I think we understood a bit better why this is the case. And as you said, I've been through various positions on the business side in banking, in payments, in fintech. I mean, over the past many years, I'm also working for a fintech company. It's called Unger. It's actually a fintech focusing on the payment space in Europe. I would say it's a B2B2C company, meaning that our clients are companies, merchants, banks, whoever wants to offer payments, end-to-end payments solutions to their end consumers. And in this way, we are servicing the end consumers. So I happen to know the space quite well. But I would say that we are moving in a direction of things being mixed up. And I think that's one of the topics that makes sense to also discuss today, why this is happening, how things are moving, what's happening in Europe, maybe if there is any difference versus things happening elsewhere in the US, for example. I think these are all very relevant issues to discuss.
Yeah, I think it's very relevant. And I think what's interesting is some of the dynamics or some of the trends that we're seeing across Africa are very different to what we're seeing in Europe, or certainly I learned a lot last week from Ron. Where I'd like to start, actually, and you mentioned kind of the payments layer, and certainly in across the African continent, 65, maybe 70% of the fintech market is focused on payments. It's the biggest sector by a long, long way for numerous reasons. But what we're seeing on top of that, and I think this has been maybe a trend that you would resonate with in Europe, is that historically there was lots of unbundled services. So you would need to have maybe 7, 8, 10 different apps on your phone or on your desktop to be able to do different things. So I'd have one for my investment portfolio, I'd have one for payments, I'd have one for lending or microfinance, I'd then have a loyalty program, and I'd have all of these different things. What we've seen over the last couple of years is kind of the rebundling of these services, and lots of companies looking at sort of creating, dare I use that term, the super app, and all vying for certain segments of the market. I think when you look at someone like Revolut, who I'm a customer of and have been for many, many years, that they've done that exceptionally well. Do you see that as a trend across Europe generally, or are there still, do consumers still want an app for investing, a separate app for payments and a separate bank account and, you know, separate loyalty schemes? What are the dynamics in that space?
I think you're spot on how you explained that we have been, and that's actually a topic that I'm always presenting. So how we went from the so-called unbundling to the rebundling, because this is exactly what has been happening. So the fintech revolution, if you may, that has been happening, I think has been a result of the so-called unbundling. So you had these so-called fintechs, the new agile companies focusing on these segments that the traditional incumbents would not have the resources or wouldn't make sense for them to focus on. So there was a gap and they were bundling. Mm. They were actually unbundling through this niche attack several segments. And I mean, companies like neobanks, like Revolut, they were focusing specifically starting from, let's say, from FX payments, things like this. And then they were expanding. And this was actually the starting point for most of the fintech revolution that we've seen over the past many years. At some point, as you rightly pointed out, there were so many apps, so many things that it became a bit confusing. So we have been seeing what you called rightly so the rebundling, meaning that you bring everything under one roof. And I think here it makes a lot of sense to differentiate between two things. I think what is happening in Europe, let's say in the West, I mean, in Europe, in the US, is a bit different from what has been happening in China, because the term super app, I think, is a term that was, let's say, invented in Asia, more specifically in China. But it's important to point out that when we say super app in China or in Asia, it's very, very different from what we might mean in the West. And there is a long discussion as to how this is going to play out in the West. But I think, for example, in Asia, super apps are touching every bit and piece of our day-to-day. So actually, if you don't have, let's say, Alipay, or if you don't have WeChat, then you are actually unable to do anything at all. Well, yeah, for many, many people, sure, in these countries, the super apps are basically their gateway to the world. I mean, if you want to call a taxi, if you want to do anything that has to do with our day-to-day, you do it through your super app. And this is not the case to what is happening in the West. I think we do have similarities between Europe and the US. You mentioned Revolut. I think we do have a few players that are now trying to get in this direction of being a super app, but it's not going to be the same for many, many reasons. I think I would say cultural reasons, competition reasons, privacy reasons, data reasons. It's not going to be the same. So I think we are indeed moving in the direction of bringing more services under one roof. I think Revolut is one of the players that does it very well. And actually, if you see the spectrum of services that you have in the West and in Europe, I think Revolut is the one that has the most, right? And you do have a few other contenders like PayPal, like Apple, but they're a bit different in terms of how they position themselves across the market. And you did have, for example, PayPal, Revolut launching eSIM a couple of days ago, and there was a big debate how this is matching to the profile of their consumers or not. I think it does. And I think this is also in the direction of what we see, let's say, in Asia and in China. So this is a trend I see. It makes a lot of sense. But I think what we need to keep is that this is not going to be what we mean. So it's not going to play out as it has in the US, where for very, very different reasons, the evolution of the financial system in China has been happening through these big, super apps, so these big companies that have been evolving and revolutionizing financial services in China. Whereas in our case, I mean, in the West, I think it's a bit different. It's not exactly, it's a transition in terms of how you are positioning yourself on the market and what kind of needs you're servicing versus your customers.
It's very interesting.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Because you talk about the digital banks in the West and you talk about the super app ecosystem in the East. And then when we look at Africa, generally, and there's 53 countries, so I'm not putting everyone into one pot, mm-hmm. but the biggest fintechs on the continent are the telecoms operators, the MNOs, the Vodacoms and the MTNs and the Airtels. And that really, when I've asked this question, certainly here in Africa, saying who's going to win the super app war? Is it going to be a fintech? Is it going to be a bank? Is it going to be a telco, or is it going to be a tech company, you know, a Microsoft or an Apple or a Google? The resounding answer is telecoms, right? The telco, the MNOs. We saw just last week that MasterCard invested $200 million in MTN FinTech, you know, here in Africa, which is a huge investment. But, you know, I think when we look at the bundling of different services, specifically within this super app realm, if you look at an Amazon, for example, or you look at a Google, then it's, you know, they have almost the infrastructure in place. I know Google Pay is big out here. I think it is in Europe as well. They have that infrastructure and that ability to do so. But there was one thing I wanted to pick up, and I don't know whether you saw, but I was kind of smiling a little bit when you said that Revolut have just launched an eSIM, right? So about a year ago, I was on a stage and I was moderating and I asked a question. And I said, do you think there's a business model for a fintech becoming a telco? And I was laughed off stage. No, it would never happen. No, that's ridiculous. Well, clearly Revolut don't think so, right? So I just wonder if that's going to be a theme, if that's going to be a trend where we're going to see fintechs acquiring MVNO licenses in order then to, you know, capture that sort of consumer. Obviously, the data they would get from consumer behavior using data or using an eSIM is going to be fundamentally different to what they receive now, what they're able to get now in terms of spending habits. Do you see that as a trend moving forward, or do you think Revolut are just sort of trying this out to see what happens?
My main comment would be the following. As long as you're servicing your customer base and their needs, then you cannot go wrong. And in this case, if you look at the profile of the Revolut customers, what exactly they are, how they are using the Revolut as a service and what they need. I mean, I was traveling a week ago and I was actually in need of this eSIM card. I was using Revolut. And if Revolut, for example, would have been in place to offer me this kind of service, I would get it. So for me, it's only about meeting your customer needs where they are. And if you are able, we are living in a world where, you know, let's say the borders are getting mixed. My business model is getting into your business model and vice versa. We have so many things moving. So as long as you can, let's say, service your customers, I mean, for me, that's the ultimate goal. And I think Revolut is rightly doing this in this space because it's matching the profile of their customers. Now, going back to because you made the point that I think your point around the infrastructure, I think that's something very specific in Africa, because I think the fintech revolution that we have seen in Africa is a bit particular in two terms. The first one is that you had the rapid uptake of mobile telephones, right? This was the only infrastructure that was in place in Africa, whereas in other places, let's say, let's take the US, let's take Europe, this has not been the case. So you did have an infrastructure to build on. So in Africa, people and companies were looking at something that would would be the basis to innovate and offer services. So that was one. So what was the most common theme? It was mobile phones. So that was one. And the second one, it was that because of the lack of infrastructure, you didn't have the banking services, right? So if you take these two things and you combine them, then you see why things have been moving in Africa like they have. I mean, and you have the M-Pesa, I think it launched in Kenya in 2007. And if I'm not mistaken, within 5 years, I think the volumes that they have been moving, I think they were probably matching a bit less than half of the country's GDP in 5 years' time. So that's amazing. I mean, that makes a difference. But that's something unique. I mean, that's very Africa-specific, right?
Again, this is a conversation I'd be having is you look at the sort of transformation or the journey, you know, if you've gone from fixed line and overhead cables mm-hmm. to having nothing and literally just relying on satellite, exactly. That sort of opportunity to go and innovate and to actually, you know, build solutions for people that are in most need. Which brings me to my next question, actually. So when we're looking at the European market, and I made this comment to Ron last week, and he was quite adamant that I was wrong, which is fine. I'm not always right. Actually, I'm very seldomly right. Let me be honest. So I said to him, you know, my opinion is fintech in developed markets, North America, Europe, it's a luxury. It's a luxury item. You know, people just have it because it makes their life easier. Whereas in developing markets, this is fundamental to people living. Okay, microfinance and payments and being able to do things on their phones. And he cut me down. He said, no, you're wrong, because in so many words, you know, you're bucketing sort of North America as all these sort of, you know, rich people, you know, driving around Hollywood and in convertible Mustangs. Whereas actually there's a big part of the population, certainly when we're looking at sort of immigrants coming in, that are actually in need and in desperate need of these types of fintech solutions, whether it be, you know, to be financially included in the US, or whether it be to remit funds back to their families, wherever they may be. So he actually sort of said, no, listen, fintech in developed markets, yes, there's different sort of LSMs, and yes, there's products for, you know, the wealthy and the employed, but there's also a big part of the market which is focused on the underserved markets. Is that the same in Europe? And if so, are fintechs... we've used Revolut. I must just say, everyone, that this is not sponsored by Revolut at all. It's just that I'm a customer and I kind of know the app really well. Someone like Revolut, are they appealing? Are they trying to appeal to the broad spectrum? Because they've obviously got their different tiers of sort of cards that you have or benefits that you can obtain. Or are you finding that there are certain fintechs that are actually focusing on different demographics and different sort of living standard metrics? What are you seeing in Europe?
I think the first one is that the definition of underserved customers in Europe is a bit different than what you would find in the US or than what you would find in Africa. And the second thing is that, you do have many immigrants, and you do have, on the other hand, lots of customers that they used to get very bad services, but there was a huge gap before the fintech revolution. And I think this was the opportunity for the fintechs to try and build on this gap, because I think that's a good way to portray this. And that's I'm trying to do this quite a lot. I think we have been moving from what I call this vertical one size fits all banking proposition that you used to have in the past only with the incumbents, and now you have this open, let's say, economy, you have more competition. And most of the times, I think, to understand what's the difference, I think you have to think of a supermarket in the communist era where you would have only one product. It's a take it or leave it approach. And now you have a normal, irregular supermarket, many brands, you know, and it's all about choice. So I think the transition is all about choice. So on the one hand side, you might very well say that in Europe, you don't have this kind of problems because everybody has an account and everybody has access to services. But on the other hand, I think there was indeed a huge gap in terms of meeting some of the needs of the customers. And this was the opportunity of companies like fintechs starting from niche segments and trying to build their business based on this. And you had companies like the neobanks, for example, starting from a very small niche, from most of the times on the payment side, most of the times offering an account with some basic functionalities. And now if you look at the major competitors, what kind of services, what kind of products they offer, I mean, we talked about the eSIM, you see a huge palette of products and services. And I think that's now the challenge. Some of these players now, they have to go to this so-called 2.0 play. And it's not very easy because it used to be all about growth. And now it's about sustainable growth, also because of the macro. So you have a really huge challenge that, you know, it has to be profitable. The investors are looking for this kind of potential. And it's not that I grow my base by an X percent every month or every year and everything is fine and I can be loss making. So these, I think, are a couple of points to throw in the discussion.
You mentioned choice for the consumer, and I completely agree. I think there's another element here as well when we're talking about fintech, and actually we're talking about financial services, and we talk about trust. Mm-hmm. Now, without trust, there isn't a financial services system, in my humble opinion. Now, Europe, by and large, is very, very heavily regulated for the right reasons. And, you know, regulation is across the planet. Do you find in Europe that consumers are more trusting of fintech solutions that come up? Or is there still a degree of skepticism around initiatives such as, and I know the general consumer, if you ask them what open banking was, they wouldn't be able to explain that. And that's a conversation I had with Chris Skinner a few weeks ago. But, you know, when we're talking about trust in fintech, trust in this kind of open banking initiatives, what is the general feeling in Europe? Are they trusting? Are they more skeptical? Do people do more research? Do people trust the regulators? Where does the land lie?
I think trust, you're spot on in terms of addressing trust. I would say that it very much depends on who's behind the service. So after COVID, and I mean, also before COVID, I think consumers are now used to the frictionless products and services offered by the big techs, right? So they're expecting that they're getting a good service and they're getting value for money. And I think that's what we're now seeing also in the financial services domain. And if we talk about things like embedded finance, meaning that everybody now is in a position to offer financial services, to integrate actually financial services in their normal flow, then you are seeing that you have all the more companies outside of traditional financial services offering financial services product. And then we go to what you mentioned before, trust. So I think there's a trend. If I know the company, if it's a big one, if we talk about the Googles and the Apples of this world or the Amazons of this world, I think there is trust because you know the name and you tend to trust the company behind because you are actually already a customer in many, many ways of these companies. So buying financial services is an extra step. But if we talk about smaller companies, I would say it's not the same. And we have been having this conversation in terms of how you see the open banking growth. And if customers are, for example, are able to trust this new payment initiation method against traditional payment methods like the credit cards. And I think trust is part of the equation why things are moving in a relatively slow way. So in conclusion, I would say trust is a very big topic. How you build trust is very, very important, and how you get and how you retain the trust, right? The big players, as I said, they have an advantage, right? I mean, that's something that you cannot ignore.
I was going to ask you, you mentioned about having, again, in our world, you know, a sponsor bank that is sort of sitting behind your fintech solution. There's a Forex company here in South Africa, a Forex and investment company called Shift. Mm-hmm. And they were incubated out of Standard Bank. Okay, so they go to market as Shift powered by Standard Bank. And that automatically, I think as a consumer, as a general consumer, it builds trust. I know Standard Bank, they've been around for, you know, 150 years, you know, they're a top four bank in Africa. I trust them. Then on the other side, we have, you know, a crypto company that comes from nowhere that says, hey, we, you know, come and invest your Bitcoin and we'll double your money overnight, which isn't backed by anyone and is running on their own rails or running on Ethereum or running on, you know, Solana, whatever it may be. And I think it's very difficult for those smaller fintechs to be able to go to market and have the same sort of impact as someone that is overtly sponsored by a big name. It comes on to my kind of final question, actually, which is, you know, 10 years ago, I was talking on stage and everyone was talking about fintegration, right? Banks working with fintechs and fintechs working with banks. We're still having that conversation 10 years later. I'm pleased to say that most of the time, there seems to be a developing understanding of, you know, banks play a pivotal role in financial services and compliance and regulation and providing the infrastructure. And what fintechs are great at, again, by and large, is the consumer facing side, is the user experience and, you know, the bundling of services. So my question is, what is the view of banks generally across Europe? Are they pro sort of fintegration? I can't believe I'm using this word 10 years later, but are they pro sort of partnering and working with fintechs? Or are they like a JP Morgan, or I think I just read last week, was it HSBC or one of the big banks who are building their own fintech sort of services and solutions, and they're trying to do that in-house? What's the general direction that banks are going in?
I think depending on the size, you might find different strategies, but you've touched upon a very important point, and this is the customer relationship, right? So in today's era, I think the one who is winning, the one who is controlling everything, is the one who has the customer relationship. And that's why, I mean, we talked before about the super apps, and at the end of the day, it's about who is controlling the customer relationship. Most of the times you don't care about what's sitting behind, as long as you are able to control the relationship and offer the products. And it used to be the case that, let's say, before the fintech revolution, let's say 10, 15 years ago, it was all about the infrastructure. So if you didn't have the infrastructure, you couldn't compete because nobody was offering this. Now with everything on the cloud and with pay-as-you-go models, that's very easy. So the challenge is, how do you address the customer? How do you keep the customer? And how do you offer to the customer the relevant things? And if you ask, because I've done a discussion, most of the banks, they're going to tell you, no, we also want to keep the customer relationship. The question is, are they in a position to really do so? Because they're competing against the likes of, you know, the big techs, some now well-known fintech names, and they are perceived as not so much innovative on the one hand side. And on the other hand side, not only perceived, but if you look at what their offering is, you don't have so many incumbent players doing this in an attractive way for the customers. So I think there is a risk at some point of them losing the customer relationship and then their offering becoming a bit commoditized, right? And as long as you are not controlling the customer and you are not perceived to be offering something that if I can find it somewhere else, then I'm fine, as long as I can offer this to the customer. So I think that's a challenge that the banks are facing today. And on the other hand, you could argue that there is an opposite view, saying that you have this now banking as a service model, right? I mean, I guess you're familiar with the concept. And for me, if there would be a very simple way to explain this, would be the following. I mean, you have this embedded finance concept. So embedded finance is what is the outcome. So what you have at the front end, and the banking as a service is what is the enabler at the back end, you know, on the basis. So you're always going to have a need to have somebody on the basis to do the unsexy stuff, the non-sexy stuff, right? I mean, you have to do compliance, you have to do risk, you have to have an operational side. So you have to have all these things. So banks are always going to be sitting at the bottom and doing this stuff. Some of them are going to be also sitting at the top, on the front end. But not everybody can do this. So if you don't have the right size, if you don't have the right specialization, if you don't have the right focus, you're not going to be able, and the right resources, you're not going to be able to play the game. So I think that's the discussion, that's the challenge. And you find the answer. I mean, you have a couple of different models and different variations. You have those who are going to be able to compete on both fronts, and you have those who might say, okay, I cannot compete on this one. But if you ask most of them right now, they're going to say, okay, I want to be the one keeping the customer relationship. And again, back to my original point, the question is, how do you do this? Can you do this in a way that makes sense for you and for the customer, or it's not something that is realistic as a strategy, as a business model?
I would guess as well, winding the clock forward, without name dropping, but I also had Brett King on the show a few weeks ago, and he was talking about, you know, what the bank's going to look like in 2050. Using that as an example, whether I'm not asking you to say whether he was right or wrong, but in terms of your view, do you see in the next sort of 20 years a bank being very different to what it is now, to being more of a banking as a service, more of a technology and compliance and risk business, as opposed to, again, owning the customer relation? And I get your previous point. So do you see, you know, the size of someone like an HSBC actually from having whatever, how many staff they have, 100,000 staff, actually having 2,000 staff, operating something in the cloud and just being able to sort of offer the rails? Do you see that as a possibility, or do you think a bank's going to remain a bank for the foreseeable future?
So I think there are going to be a few models. I don't think you're going to have a one-size-fits-all model. So you're going to have the big players, as I said before, these are probably likeliest to be able to keep and retain the customer relationship. And they're going to be able to play across a couple of fronts. So they're going to play across the technology front, the infrastructure front, and across the front end. So they're going to be able, most probably, to address the customers via their own super apps, by their own offerings, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one model. Then you're going to have the banks that are not going to be able to compete. So they're going to be focusing. So, and these are most of the times the smaller ones, right? The niche banks. So you're going to have some players focusing on what they do best. And you're going to have some players then that are not innovative, but they might be working with fintechs to cover the technology side that they're missing. And these banks might be focusing on some, let's say, niche segments like factoring, for example, right? Like targeting companies that are, or clients that have a very specific need and they cover this need, or let's say on a vertical basis. What I think banks in general will not be able to afford is that they're not going to be able to afford to continue this vertical one-size-fits-all model. So I think banks have not understood, or in some cases, many banks have not understood that if I have to offer a product or a service to my customer, I don't necessarily have to own this product or the service. I might be able to offer it, but owning it in some cases might not make sense. So that's why, for example, I might employ a platform model. At the end of the day, the customer is going to see the product is coming from me, but somebody else is going to be offering the product on the bottom. And to be honest, the customer is indifferent, because at the end of the day, if I as a bank, I need, I don't know, 2 years time to build something that is state of the art today, and I might not be sure if I will be matching the quality of the service of the state of the art that exists today, it doesn't make sense. The market is gone by the time I make it and I manage to build the product. So I think that's something that banks will have to realize. I think the ones that are successful today have realized this. But my answer would be, as I said before, you're not going to have a one-size-fits-all model. You're going to have 2-3 different models, I mentioned before, depending on the size, depending on the geographies, and depending on the capabilities of the bank.
Absolutely. Listen, I wholeheartedly agree. An interesting one for you to look at, if you've not come across them already, is Diamond Trust Bank in Kenya, DTB. They've got a new part of their business called DTBX. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're doing. They're building a platform, a banking as a service platform, to enable fintechs to plug into. And this has been conceived literally for grassroots level. It's been built in probably 18 months, right? Which for a bank is unbelievable. I think you've ever heard of that before, right? It's operational. They've got, you know, live tenants, you know, working within the platform itself. But again, they're not necessarily a tier one bank. I think they were a tier two bank, but saw an opportunity here to be an enabler. And, you know, it's a very interesting model. I think the first I've seen in Africa to do this.
Darren, the thing we do have to mention that sometimes, I mean, because theory is always good, but in practice, things tend to be a bit different. So if you look at what has been happening with Apple and Goldman Sachs, you know, you have one very big player controlling the front end and the customer relationship and everything else. And you have the other one controlling, let's say, the back end. In theory, it should work, but in practice, it didn't. So I think that's, and there's a very long discussion going on around this, what went wrong, which is probably going beyond what we have time to discuss today. But I think it's good to have this perspective that in theory, you might have things sounding well and making sense, but the way that you implement is always making a difference.
Well, Panayotis, I must say that there's been one big takeaway for me on this podcast, on this recording, and that was, listen, everyone, if I'm on stage and I'm telling you that I'm asking a question, whether there's a model for a fintech to become a telco, next time I say something like that, just take notes. I'm joking. But listen, thank you so very, very much. I think just to get I appreciate we could go on for hours. We've just, you know, hit the tip of the iceberg. But I really wanted to thank you for your time and giving us a bit of an overview in terms of what's happening in Europe and some of the trends and sort of market analysis. Panayotis, if people don't follow you already and, you know, want to learn about the world of fintech and payments and banking as a service and lending and cryptocurrency and literally everything else that you cover daily, it's a bit of a leading question, but where should people look you up?
I mean, the easiest way, they find me on LinkedIn, right? I mean, that's the easiest way to contact me. I think it's easy. If you want to find me, it's easy. I have also you're going to find my email address. So I would say that whoever, just get in touch and, you know, we take it offline, right?
Well, I will put all your links below in the description. So if anyone is interested in learning about what's happening, again, not just with the European lens, but really what's happening across the world, please do give Panayotis a follow. And now I can pronounce his name properly. I'm very proud of myself.
Very well done. Very well done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'll let you get back to your day. Again, thank you so very much for your time. I must just say a quick thank you to our sponsor, LexisNexis Risk Solutions, who have been phenomenal in supporting us and supporting the show. And without them, we wouldn't be able to sort of dedicate as much time and get amazing guests like Panayotis and the other people we've had over the last couple of years on the show. So a big thank you to LexisNexis Risk Solutions and to Panayotis. I'm going to let you get back to your day and thank you again.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you, Darren.
My pleasure.